From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear two interviews from the archives. First, a conversation with Vermont poet Ralph Culver, and after that, my interview with neuroscientist James Fallon. Ralph Culver actually has a new collection of poetry coming out soon. A Passable Man will be published by Mad Hat Press before or by September 2021. So, that's coming. Today, you will hear a conversation that I had with Ralph about an earlier chapbook, Both Distances. When we spoke, I asked him to begin by talking about Both Distances having won the Anabiosis Press chapbook contest. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I think it's a little sad in a way that, and this is really a much bigger subject than what we would have time to talk about, but I think it's a little sad, if not big sad, that our literary culture in this country has been reduced to this kind of contest, you know, entering, paying for, and then, you know, sitting around with your fingers crossed waiting to see if you've won something. And I don't really think of myself as a contest entering kind of guy. But Richard Smith, who's the publisher and editor of Anabiosis Press, also publishes a literary magazine called Albatross. And he had taken a couple of my poems in the past, and in fact three poems in this collection were poems that originally appeared in Albatross. And so one day I was just sitting there thinking, what do I have to lose? You know, I mean, like, I know the guy already likes the poems, you know, because he's already printed three of them. So I put a manuscript together for him and sent it to him. And he, you know, and after the requisite judging period was done, he called me up and said, "I just want you to know that you know, I'm choosing the manuscript." And then immediately, like almost like within actually during the same conversation, he said, "And now, you know, I want to talk to you about how I think we need to lift some of these things out of here, and I'd like for you to send me, you know, a whole bunch of other poems for me to." And the reason why he was doing this was because he felt really strongly that a chapbook in particular, which is so short, I mean, this book has, I think, 17 poems in it, has to, you know, it has to cohere in a way, at least thematically, and that is something I think a lot of poets, certainly fiction writers, obviously are going to think about that when they're putting a book together. I think a lot of poets these days have that sort of as a concern that's uppermost in their mind, and I never think about that stuff. The poem is the only thing that I care about. And Richard was, you know, he was pretty adamant. He said, "I want to, you know, I'd like to get this, sort of whip this into shape, a better shape thematically." So a lot of the poems, well, not a lot, but a few of the poems that were in the original manuscript that I sent him were taken out and replaced with other poems. And I have to say that, you know, I think that if that's a concern for the reader, that, you know, if you want to have a short series of poems that hangs together thematically or that has a good flow, and those were things that he was, you know, concerned about, that his suggestions improved the final product quite a bit. So I'm grateful to him for that.
It's amazing how often I hear that about people's experience with editorial help.
You know, it is really, it's amazing, and, like, I'm sort of at that point where I feel like, why should I continue to be amazed by that? But but it's true. It's really true. And, you know, it just goes to show, you know, one of the adages that I try to live my life by is everything is going to turn out perfectly fine and doesn't have to look a damn thing like I thought how it was going to look, or how, God forbid, it's supposed to look, right? So So that was certainly true in the case of this little book.
Now,
it,
the
it
book
ended up
the,
not looking anything like I thought it was going to look, and I think it turned out fine.
Yeah, it's beautiful. The title is Both Distances. Where's the title from?
The title's from the title is actually a line from one of the poems in the book.
Okay.
It's a poem called Field in Winter.
Okay. Well, actually, speaking of winter, because winter is coming, I was wondering if we could first have you read Prelude, which is another poem that alludes to the coming of winter,
sure.
And then we could talk about that one a little bit.
Uh-huh, yeah, all right. Prelude. Come winter. Autumn pockets her colors, pulls up the once warm roots, and hunches southward. A gray, drained hand rises. Shadow. Shadow. It stops the blood. It stops the brain's fragile traffic. It stops a buck rumping a doe grazing near fast water. He lifts a tentative hoof and peers. Every November that he began waiting to starve is coming in on the cold purpose of this wind. And I count the times I could not keep from turning to check mid-step the footprints strung behind in the climbing snow.
Thank you very much. That's great. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about how a poem starts for you. And this is, because this is the first one in the collection, it's a good place to start talking about that.
Sure.
I'm wondering, do you start with an image or a story, or is it always different?
Yes, I start with an image, I start with a story, and it's always different.
Okay.
I'm a child of someone who taught writing at a major university for like almost 40 years.
Mm.
And the only conclusion that I have come to is that the only way to become a better writer is to write and read.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that, if I am sitting in my chair and I know I want to write, and I'm stuck, I don't know what to write about, nothing is going on, you know, like my head is just completely empty. The best thing for me to do is to pick up a book what works best for me is to pick up a book of poems that I'm already familiar with, that I know I love, that
mm-hmm.
I know I just have a nice feel for. And it's amazing to me, or I guess it's stopped ceasing to amaze me, but it's inevitable that sooner or later reading is going to put me into the mind of writing, and
mm-hmm.
that's going to give me an idea. Where this particular poem is concerned, it's an older poem, and I don't remember with much, you know, specificity what its, you know, how its genesis came about. But I do remember that it was this time of year. It was November, and you know, sort of the cusp, seasonal cusp, and I was thinking about, and when I read the poem now, I see how, and this kind of, I think, hooks in with the other, thematically anyway, this idea of looking backward and looking forward.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the poem, and believe me, its structure it was certainly not anything that I was conscious of at the time, but in some way the deer is kind of looking forward, you
right.
know, anticipating, you know, maybe with some fear, you know, some anxiety, some trepidation of, you know, what might transpire. And the eye character, the person stating the poem, can't stop looking back, you know, at their own footprints. So there's an image there are two images there, one of the deer sort of looking forward and of the man looking back. And the other thing about the poem that came, that I thought was at least a statement of truth as far as I was concerned, was the narrator can't stop looking at his own footprint. So it isn't just the past that's a consideration, but the footprints themselves kind of represent, for him his own being. It's kind of not even an affirmation so much as a confirmation that he's really alive.
Like, so it's not so much his history or his steps, like that we might normally associate the metaphor footsteps with things we've done. It's almost like who he is, the entity of himself.
Or even that he is.
That there's
a kind of comfort or, you know, at least a confirmation of your own existence,
yeah,
just by looking back and seeing those footprints. And then, you know, since you brought it up, the tracks in the footprints strung behind in the climbing snow is a definite connection with Field in Winter, because tracks in snow are a major image in that poem.
And I loved that climbing snow. That's such a different way of writing about snow, because there are so many cliches about how snow falls and what it looks like. I've never heard climbing snow before, but I love that.
Well, thanks. Somebody, a friend of mine who many years ago was at the Iowa Writers Workshop, said, you know, when you go out there, crows and corn just start creeping into your poems. And I have lived now in New England, in Vermont, for so many years. I feel the same way sort of about snow,
yeah,
and winter and autumn and foliage and that kind of stuff. I feel the same way that this guy was feeling when he was talking about the corn and the crows, that he wasn't able to keep them out of his poems after, you know, living in Iowa for 2 years. There just was no way he could keep them out.
So I
spent a lot of time thinking about, what's another way to talk about snow that hasn't been talked about?
Well, that one, that's a good one. You mentioned a minute ago about form, the form of that poem, but I was wondering if we could talk about another poem in this chapbook, which is I Make Hot Cereal on a Morning in Late March. There was something about the form that I either noticed or invented in my mind, and I wanted to know if it was purposeful. So I wonder if you could read that one next.
Sure.
Okay.
I make hot cereal on a morning in late March. A chickadee alights, spears one sunflower seed from the feeder, and flees. Over steaming bowls, salted and sweet, full as a well in springtime, we laugh, we lift our spoons. The chickadee returns again and again.
Thanks for reading that. I really love it. It's funny, sometimes I read poems and I love the poems, and it's not until I go back and start to study them that I see things I didn't notice the first time. But I think sometimes I'm seeing things that are just of my own creation and not necessarily. I just wanted to ask you about this. So this poem has three sections or stanzas of three lines each. All the first lines have a likeness in that they end in a word that ends in S. So alights and bowls and spoons. And then the second line of each stanza starts to sound like it's going to have likeness. So there's seed and there's sweet. But then in the third stanza, the second line has returns, which is more like those first lines. And it has to do with the return of the chickadee, but it's also a return of the S-ending word. And I wondered, is that something that you worked into the poem's form?
It's not something I worked into the poem's form, but, it's funny. I had a conversation with someone once who said, do you want to talk about your poems, or do you think they should stand on their own? And my feeling about that is, regardless of what I say about the poem, it's going to stand on its own anyway.
That's,
you know,
true.
So if you see something in it, whether I consciously was aware of putting it in there or not, it certainly, it happily in this case, you know, exists for you. So I guess the only thing I would say about this one is I'm very much in love with Eastern forms of poetry, haiku, tanka, that sort of thing. The three-line stanza just seemed appropriate. Uh-huh. And if there's a sound, the S endings, that's interesting. I had not thought of that before. But the long E sound of chickadee, feed, feeder, flea, that's something steaming. That's a sound that repeats itself over and over.
And again. Spear and sweet, yeah.
Right, exactly. Although, interestingly, you mentioned the third stanza. The only time that sound appears in the third stanza is when the word chickadee is
yes.
repeated.
Right.
But I am always conscious, if I can say it this way, whether I'm conscious or not, I'm always conscious of at least two things about a poem when I'm in the middle of writing it. And one is rhythm and the other is music. And, you know, I think music doesn't really exist, to my mind, in a lot of ways without rhythm. But in a poem, the music of a poem is in its sound. So between those two things, sound and rhythm, those are really, really paramount for me. And another thing that's really important for me in creating a poem is, I think Frost famously said, this may not be a word for word quote, but he said, when we write poetry, we go a sentencing. I love sentences. I just, you know, and the movement of a sentence, the rhythm of a sentence, the sound of a sentence, and how that can be improved by things like line breaks and rhyme and that sort of thing, is those are all things that I'm really careful about in my mm-hmm. considerations for how the poem is going to look and sound, you know, when it turns out.
Right, right, right. Okay, great. You mentioned your enjoyment of Eastern poetry mm-hmm. forms. And so I wondered if we could look next at your poem, Koan of a Sort.
Yeah, sure. Koan of a Sort. The sounds of water as she rises from her bath while I slice bread in the kitchen. How can I still feel sorry for myself?
Thank you for reading that. Okay, so that's just a tiny little poem, but it has so much going on. To me, this is it's a complete story, or at least for my own tastes, it's a complete story, because I kind of like a little subtlety. But I wondered if you could talk about the challenge of writing something complex and short.
Well...
And you might disagree with me about this being complex, but I feel like it does a lot more than you might normally expect from something so little.
Well, that's one of the things that I love about the great Japanese and Chinese writers. I don't know what I was reading. I was reading someplace about the length of a poem, and the writer was saying, you know, a long poem for Dante is very different than a long poem for, you know, someone who is writing from an Eastern tradition like haiku or tanka or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
A long poem for Dante can go on for 300 pages. A long poem for, you know, Busan or something like that might only be 24 lines. The thing that I love about and that attracts me so much about Eastern practice, and it's also a spiritual practice, I think, as well as a literary one, is you know, compression.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can get into three lines what, you know, if you can have the kind of economy where you can get the sort of emotional and the emotional impact for the poem's purposes or for the reader's purposes in three lines, why not? You know, I mean,
right.
why not say in three lines what you might otherwise take, you know, 20 to say? Now, and then, of course, I can immediately think of like a zillion different reasons why you would want to take the 20 lines, you know. But in the instance of this particular poem, I think compression really is, or really was, important. First of all, you have to know kind of what a koan
mm-hmm.
is. The poem assumes that if the reader doesn't know that, then they're going to go to the dictionary or Google, you know, and look it up. But, you know, if you know what a koan is, it, you know, and there is a little irony, I think, in the title of, you know, calling this koan of a sort, which I hope has a little bit of humor.
Yeah, it. I thought it was.
Good. I'm really glad to hear that, because talk about something else that's hard to get into three lines, you know, unless it's like a limerick.
It's humor.
You know, it's humor, right.
Right.
This three-line poem is extremely compressed, but I was very pleased with how it turned out.
Did it,
because it said everything I wanted to say.
Did it just pop out, or did you have to work at it?
You know, it popped out, but I can tell you I can be more specific sort of about the origin of this poem.
Okay.
And I can tell you it came about on a day when a poem I love dearly is a guy named Jack Gilbert, who died recently.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a line in one of his poems about, well, he's I think he's even in another room or maybe not, but the sounds of water while his, you know, beloved is bathing or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that image was kind of sticking with me. I think I was, as I often do when I sit down to write, I will start kind of as an exercise by trying to write some haiku-like thing, you know, sticking with just a few words, maybe three lines, maybe five at the most, not necessarily paying attention to the syllabic count, because I can be a stickler sometimes, depends on the mood I'm in, but I'm not always a stickler about that. But I do like to think about things like a season, an image from nature, you know, those kinds of things, which are important to, you know, Eastern tradition in poetry. And so I kind of had in my head this image of a guy listening to his lover bathing.
Right.
And for me, it turned into, in the first two lines of the poems, this image of abundance in a way, and contentment, you know, the bread even is a little bit of a chestnut, I thought, like, oh God, is he it? We have to have another line about slicing bread, but, you know, this this idea that everything, you know, everything is just absolutely perfect, and then the last line just came just sort of naturally on the heels of that thought, you know, like, with everything this good, how can I still feel sorry for myself? Because I do. For some reason, whatever that reason is, I feel sorry for myself, like, poor me, you know?
Right.
And how could you really, if you had any sort of clarity, either in your mind or your heart, about your circumstances, how could you feel sorry for yourself in,
right,
sort of in the midst of this contentment or this abundance, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and that's the Cullen piece of it, you know. Then that's the thing that's supposed to sort of crack your brain open and
and give you a little guidance.
Give me a little bit of a little guidance or another way of looking at it.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That was really wonderful, and particularly in because of its brevity and. Yeah, it's wonderful. I'm actually going to skip ahead a little bit, Ralph, so that we can definitely get to this one poem I want to discuss before we're finished. And that is Fishing with My Father and the Craft of Poetry.
Yeah, sure.
It's a poem toward the end of the chapbook, and it's, to me, it seems like such a perfect poet's poem. So I wonder if you can read it, and then we'll talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Fishing with My Father and the Craft of Poetry. Hours holding the poles over the water. Hours of catching nothing or not much. And throwing back what we did catch. What the hell was that about, anyway? And yet today I have this patience for things that drive some people crazy, standing in line at the supermarket, waiting for some fool blowhard to stop gabbing, searching for a coat button in the snow. The finely honed conviction that beneath this nothing is a deeper, richer nothing. Consecrating myself to the silence, and then to what interrupts the silence.
Mm-hmm. Thank you again. I really love the acknowledgement that patience is a big part of the deal and that some people just don't have it. You know, for life and also for, you know, the poet, writing poetry, understanding and appreciating poetry, or not understanding it but appreciating it. You know, like there's so many different things that patience can allude to in this poem.
Thank you.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about it a little bit, how this poem came to be?
Fishing with my father was one of the few things that I actually did with him.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't something that carried through in our lives or in our relationship really past my adolescence.
Okay.
So this is a very, you know, childhood or pre-adolescent for the most part, an association that I had with my dad. I think a lot of people think about fishing. It's like this kind of, you know, exotic fly casting stuff, you know. With my dad, fishing was like a bamboo pole with, you know, a line hanging off the end of it, a little bit of, you know, nylon leader, a couple of, you know, shots of lead for weight, and a hook with a worm on it. I mean, that was literally what his idea. Like, you know, or maybe you got in a rowboat and you rowed out. You know, you either did that from shore, mm-hmm. or you rowed out in a rowboat, you know, and you hung your pole over the side of the boat, or you stood there on the shore and you held it, and that was fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that is not that sort of exotic idea that I think that some people have about, you know, the incredible sort of skill and artistry that's involved with casting flies and tying flies and all that other kind of stuff.
Right.
So it was just, it literally was just hours, you know, holding the poles over the water. I mean, the first three lines of the poem are just a very literal description of what it was like for me to fish with my dad.
Right. And it's funny because the fourth line read to me like humor, but in fact, as you're describing it, I was sort of thinking, well, actually, maybe that's an honest question that the poet is asking. What the hell was that about anyway?
Well, it was. I am grateful that you point out the humor there, because I hope that that's clear. But I think it is, on some level, a really important question. You know,
yeah.
I mean, what about this exactly was fill in the blank? You know, pleasurable, exciting. You know, what was it exactly that made it something that, you know, that he wanted to do, or that he wanted to, you know, drag me, you know, along with him to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really, important to point out anyway, that at least directly, the poem doesn't really have an answer to that question.
Right.
You know?
But in a way, that's part of the beauty of the poem for me too, is just like, clearly this man is no longer around to answer any questions. And that's part of what we need patience for, and to find deeper, richer nothing, you know, because you're not going to get ants. I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I thought that was part of the beauty of this.
No, I think I'm grateful that you say that, because if that, in fact, is what came true for you, then the poem is doing exactly what I hoped that it would
uh-huh.
do.
Great.
You know, another, for me, interesting thing about the, I'll say right away that I am in many ways a terribly impatient person, but there are certain types of patience that I seem to have in abundance. And I was kind of sitting around while I was working on this poem wondering what would be good images of that, like what would be good examples of the kind of patience that I'm talking about, and the kind of patience that that I do seem to have.
Yeah.
And so those images of, you know, standing in line at the supermarket, I mean, these are things, these are just three examples of things that I think really do make some people kind of nuts, you know?
Like, yeah.
I freaking hate standing in, you know, standing in line at the bank or the supermarket or at, you know, trying to get your driver's license renewed. I mean, all that kind of stuff, you know?
Right. The other thing was the language, fool blowhard to stop gabbing. I don't know about your father, but that sounds a lot like my father.
Oh.
So I wondered if that voice was coming through from the father.
My father was a writer. He was a fiction writer and a teacher of writing for many years. But he was a very reserved, quiet guy.
Different guy.
Most of the time. But he had an enormous amount of patience for listening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, to what other people were saying, what other people were talking about. And so I think that in some sense I was able to pick up some of that. But in the poem, the line doesn't say anything about listening. It's just, you know, like waiting for the other person to stop talking.
Yeah, yeah.
And searching for a coat button in the snow is the kind of thing, like some people would say, forget it. You know, like, go get another button. Or you don't need that button. Or who cares?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, but, you know, these are the sorts of things that I do seem to have a sort of boundless patience for. One of the wonderful things that I cherished about those, you know, even though on the one hand I can say, what the hell was that about anyway?
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I cherished that time where you just were at ease and at peace with yourself, your surroundings, what you were doing. And clearly, even the point wasn't like, we're going to catch fish and take them back to the cabin and fillet them and eat them. You know, the fish are thrown back.
Yeah.
Like, what exactly is the point?
Is the point.
And the last four lines of the poem really are about, at least a little bit more earnestly, brings in the idea of the craft of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think everything that comes before that obviously is leading up to those last four lines. So I think, you know, in a sense the whole poem is about the craft of poetry. But the culmination for me in the poem is in the last two lines.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you just read those two lines one more time? And
consecrating myself to the silence and then to what interrupts the silence. That, for me, is a very compressed and, for me, surprisingly lucid description of exactly what I do when I write a poem. You know, I mean, it's just a lot of it is just sitting and waiting. And suddenly something happens, and then you have to pay attention to what suddenly happened.
Yeah.
And that's what, that's for me, that's what writing poetry is about in many ways.
Great. So I want to just re-mention the name of the chapbook, Both Distances, Poems by Ralph Culver. Are these available anywhere locally?
Yeah, they are. The last I knew, Phoenix, downtown Burlington, Phoenix Bookshop, has some copies.
Okay.
And they are also, I believe, available at Bear, there were a couple of copies at Bear Pond in Montpelier.
Okay.
And they're also available. You can order them directly from the publisher. And the website is www.anabiosispress, all one word, .org.
Okay. All right. Well, Ralph Culver, thank you very much for being my guest on Write the Book. It's a pleasure to read your poems and talk about them with you.
Well, Shayla, it's a pleasure talking to you, and I'm really glad that I had an opportunity to share a little time with you. So thank you very much.
From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with local poet Ralph Culver. You can learn more about his work at pw.org on his Poets and Writers directory page. You can also go to his author's page at Amazon. And just again to tell you, his upcoming poetry collection is A Passable Man, coming soon from Mad Hat Press. Next up today, we have an interview from the archives with the award-winning neuroscientist and writer James Fallon, author of The Psychopath Inside, a neuroscientist's personal journey into the dark side of the brain, which tells the story of Fallon's reaction to his own research discovery that he has the brain of a psychopath. He had gone searching for the biological hallmarks of a murderer, and that trail led a little close to home. He has at least 8 potential killers in his family tree, among them the notorious Lizzie Borden. When I spoke with him, I began by asking him to explain what exactly is a psychopath. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, nobody can agree what a psychopath is. There's a couple reasons for that. You know, it's really, psychopath is defined really well for the, you know, for the group involved by Robert Hare in the 90s. It was mostly a criminal population. So he defined that for, first of all, for male incarcerated criminals, and then for adults, and then adolescents, and then he brought in changes, revised it for females. But it's still a forensic tool, and it's still not recognized in the diagnostic manual for psychiatry and psychology as a thing in itself, even though we know that there are those traits that are
right.
named in. But as a single thing, there's a lot of overlap with other syndromes, narcissism, other personality disorders, sadism. So is it a clean thing in itself or just a mishmash of traits? But nonetheless, a part of that's carved out because there are two main factors of psychopathy, as defined by Hare. And the first one is how you interact with other people, kind of the social interactions.
Right.
And the second has to do more with criminality, and antisocial personality disorder. Much of the second part has to do with criminality. And people in the field, I'd say half the people, they really wonder if that's a core sort of feature of psychopathy, that is the criminal sort of violent component.
Mm.
Those are some of the problems involved with that, but
with defining.
Nonetheless, the traits are true.
Yeah. Okay. All right. At some point in your own story that's part of this book, you began consulting with lawyers who were trying to defend psychopathic killers. So I wonder if you can talk about how this came to be.
Yeah. For years, starting in the 70s, I actually started with an interest in the biological basis of personality when I was at St. Michael's College. I went there from 65 to 69.
Yeah, I know. I was excited to read that. I was going to mention that.
Yeah, so I got my, the kind of the first nugget was when this film called Charlie came out. He's 68. And I saw that. I always wanted to be a biologist, but I said, that's where it's going.
Yeah.
And I was, I was smart when I was a junior in college, apparently, because I went for that and it turned out to be true. So that was my general interest in the, the brain and behavior. Now, but I really became a neuroscientist, kind of a basic neuroscientist, and spent many years in the past, especially the last 15 or so, on adult stem cells. And but before that, really basic stuff on the chemistry of the brain, et cetera. But then in the 1990s, early to mid-1990s, my colleagues had just gotten a PET scanner, imaging device, that could look into a living human doing different tasks and to see what circuits are active. And since I was teaching, and have been teaching for years, the neuroscience course, neuroanatomy course, to medical students and graduate students, I knew a lot about the whole brain, human brain. So they said, let's get Fallon over. He knows the whole brain. So I sat down and started analyzing these, and it turned out that these were PET scans from really bad, bad guys.
Right.
These were mostly serial killers, murderers, and I did that one or two a year, and that went on for years. And I never, it's just like a real side thing. So I wasn't really into psychopathy per se, as a specific thing. I did that, and then in the mid-2000s, I started to get all sorts of scans from different people. And the number I got all at once went up. And I put them out in front of me, and I said, is there a pattern in these guys? And I found out there was.
Yeah.
And that pattern was they all had this underlying low activity in their part of the frontal lobe, quote, orbital cortex, right above the eyes, and in their temporal lobe, in the amygdala, it's kind of your id, and the limbic or emotional cortex that connects them. They all had that. I said, my God, there's a pattern.
Right.
And as a neuroanatomist, I love patterns. So I started to talk about it, wrote a paper, and said, here's the idea that psychopaths, all this basic underlying loss, either through damage or in utero or the combination of genes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of testing that idea for about a year, and a couple of things happened at the end of that year at the same time, which is very strange. We happened to also be looking at Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
We were doing a study looking at the genetics, what the new genes we could find that would make people susceptible. And as part of that, we needed more normals. So I asked my family. I said, we have no full families in. Do you want to come in? I asked my wife and my kids, my brothers, especially in addition to needing normals, my wife, her mother and father died of Alzheimer's.
Okay.
And people in her family have it. So I said, this would be a chance if you want to do it, if you want to risk finding out if you get the brain pattern and the genes susceptible to it. And she went along with it. Because she just about died from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma about 6 years before. She says, I'm going to die of lymphoma before Alzheimer's. She has a very funny sort of attitude about it.
Wow, yeah.
She's a stoic gal, and so we did it. And I had that done, and all those scans came back, and the genetics, and it turned out that all of the scans looked quite normal. So we were ecstatic that there was no sign or the genetics didn't point toward any Alzheimer's.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And but then I looked at one scan, and it was, it was completely abnormal. It looked like the murders I've been studying. Of course, it turned out to be mine. The genetics came back, same thing. I had all these alleles associated with high aggression, violence, and low empathy. So I had two biological markers that were off the charts.
Yeah, yeah. What was your first reaction? You write about this in the book, obviously, but for people who haven't read the book yet, what was your first reaction to seeing that scan?
I just laughed. I was with the, I looked at it and I looked up at the technician and we just chuckled. And I said, oh, this is, I get the joke. You know, I've been studying this for years and now I'm it. And really, that was my reaction. And we were really busy with this gene discovery for Alzheimer's and schizophrenia and my new company for adult stem cells. And I kind of just got lost, you know, after that because we're so busy otherwise. And then more genetics came back, and it looked worse for me in terms of my biological markers. So as more data came in, I finally said, okay, I'm not a... I first laughed, and the second time I didn't laugh so much.
Yeah.
And then the third time I said, is there something that I don't know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that is a lot about what the book is. It's not what I've given in talks, but what then that sort of quest and disturbing news was following that. And
right.
You know, you think you know, you're supposed to know who you are when you're 21. Certainly by 60. And I found out at 63, I didn't know who I was. I mean, just, you know, and I'm really kind of with it guy.
Yeah. It was very interesting to me that the evidence wasn't just scientific, that as you started to look into it, your ancestry was sort of rife with murderers, some of them quite famous, like Lizzie Borden was a notable example.
Yeah. Within about 2 months of all of those things happening, both the scans and the genetics, at a party at my house, my mother was still alive. She's 96 and full of it. And she said, your cousin sent me a book. You got to like check this out. It's about your father's family, not hers, of course. And we sat down. I said, Ma, just hold on a second. I waited till we ate and went into the office. She said, look at here. And yeah, the first incidence of matricide in the colonies, of the killing of a mother by a son, was my grandfather, great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. And it got worse after. She goes, no, look further. And there's all these other murders in that line of Cornells. We're Cornells. One of them tails off into Ezra Cornell. You know, that's great, at Cornell University. And the other one tails off on Lizzie Borden.
Oh, wow. Now, Lizzie Borden, in fact, was absolved of that crime. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she was absolved of it. And, you know, some of the murders in the family, they were never convicted or there wasn't enough evidence. And it turns out that in three lines on my father's side, there are murderers and people who abandon their families, but they only do it to their own family.
Mm.
They don't kill outside the family. So, you know, in a way, they can hide it. So that's what puts the Lizzie and other things up in the air, because it's easier to hide killing your own, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot in their family, but, you know, those kind of genetics should wash out after one or two generations. But it's just curious that we have so much in our family.
Now, this was bringing it back to you for a minute. This was very interesting to me. In chapter 7 of The Psychopath Inside, you titled this chapter "Love and Other Abstractions," and you write about your own discovery that you had a certain lack of empathy that you hadn't realized before. That in looking at yourself a little more closely, you learn that you don't have the emotional connection with people that maybe you once thought you had or assumed that you had. And so my question is, now that you know this about yourself, are you able to kind of use your cognitive ability to correct it? Or, you know, in other words, can you kind of fake empathy?
Yeah, that's a good insight. What I found, because I ended up asking people, I went back and asked people in high school, 80 college friends,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is in the past couple, one or two years. And of course, all my family, and I asked everybody, and they told me about all the crazy, really irresponsible things I had done and gotten away with. And I said, that's fine. You know, just like a college party guy, except it was going into my 30s and 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And and then I asked all the psychiatrists I know who have known me for many years and know me well. And they said, well, and they all said the same thing. Jim, we've been telling you for years that you have all these psychopathic traits. You just never listened. In fact, when my wife saw the scans, and I said, Diane, I said, you know, this is what these murders look like. This is what psychopathy. And she said to me, this was curious. She goes, I'm not surprised. And I said, what?
Wow.
You've been married? I said, we dated from the time we were 12, and now you're telling me this? You know, you're not surprised? And it's that weird. But they all agreed that I had it. When I put the question to them, what do you really think? I'm not going to do anything to you. What do you really think? They all said the same thing. And when they did, I didn't care.
Yeah.
Which was kind of the proof. I still don't care.
That actually ties to another question I have, which was, are you sensitive when it comes to being hurt by others? And it sounds like the answer is no.
I can easily blow off anything. I really, you know, and I've been able to get away with certain things because I don't show any sort of sign of guilt. And I can just laugh things off. And, you know, in little scrapes with the law, they always let me go because I make them laugh. And I don't seem, if I'm guilty, I'm not a bad guy. And so I've always been able to talk my way out of those situations where people in my group may have spent the night to clank. And so it's a style where I can be furious and you'll never know. I could be furious at you and you'll never know.
Mm.
And one of the traits that, you know, a couple of psychiatrists told me, they said, it's not psychopathic to get angry and furious at somebody when they do something to you. And then even to yell and scream at them. But what you do is you hide it and come back 3 years later to get even. That's psychopathic.
Mm.
And so, you know, until I really got into it, I didn't see all of my behaviors in this way. And they went through each one, these psychiatrists, and said, it's A, B, C, D. The way you do it is psychopathic. And but as a challenge, you know, after I found this out, I said, maybe I can change myself. But I knew I couldn't feel what apparently other people feel, connectivity to people very close to them. But I can fake it.
Yeah.
And so I asked my wife, I said, look it. And I asked my mother, my kids, I said, I'm going to try to be a better guy. And they said, we know you won't need it, but they appreciated it anyway. So for the past year, I've been trying really to be conscientious and a good guy. And they like it, even though they know that I don't feel it yet.
Yeah. Interesting.
And that surprised me. People just want to be treated well. And whether you mean it or not, is maybe not as important as one would think. Of course, they have to live with me, so who knows?
Now, when I was reading the book, it struck me that it might be difficult to study yourself so closely and put so much out there on the page about your own emotional makeup, but maybe not if this is the person that you are.
No, you know, when I was going through it, it was a game to me.
Mm.
It was just another game. And so for me, it was kind of exciting. This is like scientifically interesting, and it's cool to delve into it and how are people reacting. I just thought of it, it's almost I was out of my own body and mind on it, like I do most things. I'm just not caught up in it. So I really didn't get upset. I knew I should be. You know, people would say, Jim, that should upset you, and it's not upset. I said, no, it's interesting and it's fun.
Yeah.
So this, it's not like I'm dour, but for me, it's just a game.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have a problem, but I never thought it was that interesting either. You know, I was asked to do that TED Talk.
Right.
And it was at a time when they weren't putting them on YouTube, so I just thought I was talking about audience. And I asked my wife, I said, should I talk about this? She goes, what the hell? Nobody's going to hear it. Of course, they put it on YouTube, and bang, there we are.
Yeah.
And that kind of opened the floodgates to all sorts of things with the Wall Street Journal, with Criminal Minds, with the BBC and CNN and everything. And I was surprised at first, why are people so interested in this thing?
Yeah, yeah.
Because from my side, it's just sort of like, oh, that's kind of interesting, you know, as a scientist. But, you know, when I realized how much I had hurt people and how much danger I put people in over the years and how much they... I could see the damage I had done and had continued to do, so I had to try something. And I think part of it, because I didn't have an agent to go, you know, do you want to write a book? It kind of came to me. I did have an agent, you know, Jane Distel, who was great, but I got called by several agents who had seen the talks and said, you want to write a book? I hadn't thought of it, so I never tried to write it. But I agreed to. Obviously, I wanted to do it. Right?
Yeah,
once I
yeah.
talked into it, it was never work to get to the point of saying, okay, here's the advance. You write the book, and here's the schedule. And I know, being a scientist, you know, to write anything like that that's in the public, whether it's a novel or nonfiction like this or a grant or a scientific paper, you got to be thick-skinned.
Right.
And you got to not care.
Yeah.
You're going to get rejected 10, 20 times before anything's accepted. And I think a lot of creative people can't handle that. But with me, I say, bring it on. So, you know, part of my psychopathic traits is that I don't care and I just blow things off. So it actually has helped me deal with publishing. Because to me, it's all a challenge. If I get rejected, what the hell? I can move on to the next one.
That's very interesting. That's a silver lining.
Yeah, right.
One thing I loved about the book was how very seamlessly you kind of organized and mixed together science, history, and your personal story. And I wondered, maybe as our last question, I think we're kind of running down on the clock, but I wondered if you have any advice for writers about organizing a nonfiction book that might have several aspects to explore and how you do those transitions so beautifully.
Well, I wrote it three different ways.
Mm.
I separated out first the science and the personal story and the history of it, as it were. And that didn't quite work. Then I wrote it completely interleaved. That is, you know, in each chapter, interleaving the personal story with the science, with the history. And that worked a lot better. And I tried other things. So, you know, I had to write it three times, really.
Okay.
And kept the core was there, but just rearranging it. And it's the moment that you can see that a reader, a lay reader, will say, ah, that's interesting science, and a personal story gives a motivation to read more, and the history I read, that is like my family. And I was a lot of that in there. Once those pieces were put together in that way, the editor and everybody said, that's it. But I had to write it several times, parts of it. So it's a little bit of work.
Yeah, just sort of trial and error and keep trying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so I suppose you probably know that this show comes out of Burlington. So do you have any messages for St. Michael's College community?
Well, I was in Burlington from 1965 to 69, Burlington, Winooski, and I had a wonderful time.
Yeah.
I got my biology degree there and caused mayhem to maximum I could and had a great time. And, you know, it was such a good school, but I was... Early on, had really obsessive compulsive disorder and hyper-religiosity. I was Catholic Boy of the Year from Albany. And I went from that to this animal, right? But I was so tormented by my own sense of religiosity and my obsessions that a priest there, who's a wonderful guy, he said, I'm going to help you get out of it. He says, you got to leave the church. So here's a priest talking somebody out of the religion. This takes guts.
So
the people, the clergy that were my teachers there were wonderful. And you talk about liberal-minded. That defines it.
Yeah, that's...
But I love, you know, Burlington. I love the fishing and the skiing and everything. I went there to ski on the ski team and played football. But the whole place now, it's continued to get better and better. I go back there, and it's just wonderful.
Yeah, great. Well, I really, really enjoyed reading your book, James Fallon, The Psychopath Inside. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Sheila, thank you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with James Fallon. You can learn more about him at his University of California, Irvine faculty page. This week's Write the Book prompt is, again, a visual prompt. head on over to ratethebook.podbean.com to see a photograph, which you can use for inspiration right from your reaction to the picture. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I've been closing out the show regularly with thoughts about the pandemic and encouraging you, mainly, especially, to take care of yourself, be safe, wear a mask, socially distance. We're coming into the hopefully final weeks and months of this thing, but we still have to be very careful, maybe even more careful than ever, because people are starting to feel like it's safe and it isn't. It almost is, maybe, but not yet. I would like to encourage you to support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs, and following their virtual book tours and finding your way to their books. For all of you who are trying to write these days, be sure to check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode offers a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can access the podcast also at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it wherever you find it. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.